In his previous New York Times bestseller, The Geography of Bliss, Eric Weiner searched for the happiest places in the world. Now in his new book, The Geography of Genius, a search for the world's most creative places, from ancient Athens to Silicon Valley, the travel writer and former NPR correspondent sets out to examine the connection between our surroundings and our most innovative ideas. Eric Weiner is a philosophical traveler. His books include the New York Times bestseller, The Geography of Bliss and Man Seeks God. He is a former foreign correspondent for NPR, and his work has appeared in the New York Times, Slate, and the LA Times. Again, the title of the new book is The Geography of Genius, and we welcome Eric Weiner back to the roundtable. Eric, thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure, Joe. Happy to be here.
Always nice to have you on the program. What brought you to the genius aspect after looking at bliss?
Well, just as I was not and am not a particularly happy person, I'm not a genius either. But I'm interested in the subject, in much the way that a naked person's interested in clothing and a hungry person's interested in filet mignon. It's an aspirational search. I am looking to be a bit more creative, if not an actual genius. And, you know, I see the world through the prism of place. That's the way I wrap my mind around ideas, by getting on a plane and going somewhere. And I firmly believe that when it comes to creative genius, place matters, and it matters a lot more than we think.
So did that come from a hunch or a thought that you had that we were looking at this idea of genius in the wrong way?
Well, I've always, you know, had these nagging doubts about the two main theories or really myths about creative genius. One is that geniuses are born, that it's all genetic, that a few of us, lucky few, are sort of win the genetic lottery and come out with amazing musical or scientific abilities. And that didn't sit well with me. And in fact, recent research shows that genetics, while important, are a relatively small piece of the genius puzzle. But there's a second theory or myth of genius, which is that geniuses are made through hard work, and that, you know, perhaps you've heard of the 10,000-hour theory. It takes at least 10,000 hours of practice, right, over 10 years to master a particular field and become a genius, perhaps. That seems incomplete also, because there are lots of people who work very hard and only a few who become geniuses. I think the missing ingredient really is location, time and place, actually. Because, you know, just take a look at the world map, and look at it historically, and look at where these geniuses have popped up. It hasn't been randomly. It's not like you find one in Vegas and one in Siberia and another one in Argentina. They appear in groupings, in what I call genius clusters. And these clusters have appear periodically over time in different parts of the world. They're almost always cities. And clearly something was in the water back then. And what I wanted to know in researching this book is, what was it, and can we bottle it? Can we learn lessons from these places?
Is this a version of the nature versus nurture debate?
It is, but it's examining, I dispense with nature fairly early in the book and really hone in on nurture. And I'm looking at nurture in a slightly different way, I think, than other people have. Nurture, we tend to think of, well, the family life, for instance, of these geniuses. And I certainly do touch upon that throughout the book. You know, geniuses tend to come from middle-class families. They tend to have suffered some sort of trauma as a child, typically the loss of a parent at a young age, which a disproportionate number of geniuses have. I certainly examine that. But I also sort of widen the lens and look at society at large, at these cities, really. What was in the air more generally? Because, you know, we all breathe the same air, and we all are affected by not only what happens at home, but what happens out on the street and in the workplace. And so that's what I took a look at, and hopefully in a fun way, too, because I travel to these places and have some adventures and meet some absolutely fascinating characters.
So let's talk about these genius clusters, these certain places at certain times that have produced this crop of brilliant minds and ideas. You do focus on a handful of these in the book. How hard was it to decide which ones you were going to explore further?
Rather difficult, because I could have easily written a 2,000-page book. There have been quite a few of these places. And had I included all of them, or even all the ones I wanted to include, as I said, it would be a hefty tome. So what I did is I chose places that represented different flavors of genius, where there were maybe different ingredients or different proportions of ingredients that were involved. I also wanted some geographic diversity. I could have written a book where I never left Western Europe, plenty of genius clusters there, but the West does not have a monopoly on creative genius. So, you know, I also went to Hangzhou, China, and looked at what was going on in the 13th century there. I went to Calcutta, a city not normally associated with genius, like, at least not today, but, you know, popped there in the year 1880 or 1910, and you would find lots of genius in the air. So I tried to come with the cross-section, basically, and also places that personally fascinated me.
You do write about ancient Athens and saying that this was a place that ultimately produced more brilliant minds than any other place in the world has seen before or since. What's the takeaway from that? What do we understand about Athens and why that was the case?
Well, there are a few takeaways, I would say. One is, although it seems obvious now, of course, Athens, at the time it was not obvious. It was not an of course. It was not, you know, of the hundreds of Greek city-states at the time, it was not the biggest, it was not the wealthiest, it was not the strongest militarily. And that's often the case, by the way, with these genius clusters. They're unexpected. They're dark horses that you wouldn't expect to rise to the top, number one. Number two is that life was lived very communally. And by that, I mean there were intersections of people and ideas coming together, often over wine. They held symposia, which means literally drinking together. And they drank this watered-down wine, stayed up late at night, reciting poetry, playing word games, sharing ideas. That's common of all places of genius. It takes different forms, but people get together and cross-pollinate. Number three, I would say, is Athens was an outwardly looking city. By that, I mean that they traveled, they were great seafarers, they brought back goods, and they brought back ideas. And the sort of dirty little secret of the ancient Greeks is that they were great moochers, especially the Athenians. They borrowed, stole, if you want, ideas from the Egyptians, the Mesopotamians, the Babylonians, different parts of the world. But as Plato said, what the Greeks borrow from foreigners, they perfect. And that's what they did. And that's what all these places do. They, including Silicon Valley today, they don't necessarily invent much, but they perfect a lot.
One of the things that surprised me in the book, you just mentioned Silicon Valley, that the geniuses of Silicon Valley, you say, and the genius of Silicon Valley really has very little to do with technology, which is so
right.
often associated with the place.
Right. The product is technology, right? But the process is not. And it's not like the people of Silicon Valley really have access to technology the rest of us don't. So they're producing great technological products, but they're doing it as people, and they're doing it in a system, and that's sort of the key, is that where Silicon Valley excels is, again, not with new ideas, because very little is actually invented there. The cell phone, venture capital, I believe even the MP3 player invented elsewhere. But you go to Silicon Valley with an idea, and there's a system that it can get slotted into. So first of all, they're great discerners. Venture capitalists and others are, well, not always good, but pretty good at seeing the potential of an idea and separating good ideas from bad ones. And once they've identified a good idea, they say, well, you should talk to so-and-so. Who should talk to so-and-so? You know, there's this theory called the strength of weak ties, which I think explains a lot of Silicon Valley, that weak ties, the sort of informal relationships we have on, I don't know, Facebook, for instance, are actually very helpful when it comes to the creative process. You gain more from having a weak tie than a strong one, like a dear friend or a close family member.
And as you point out again in the book, that if we look at history, Silicon Valley will not remain a genius cluster for very long. There is an expiration date usually on this.
Yeah, absolutely. Even though people out there will tell you they're going to last forever, historically speaking, that's not the case. These genius clusters, they shine bright for a few decades, half a century, maybe a century if they're lucky, and then poof, they're gone. And it's almost like they're fragile elements of the periodic table that can only hold together for so long. They don't last long, and I don't think Silicon Valley is an exception to that historic rule. Hopefully, you know, for their sake and ours, they will learn the lessons of history. They will come up with not only new creative products, but new ways of being creative, and stay fresh and stay nimble. And most of all, not get arrogant. You know, it's this creeping vanity that sort of seeps into these places. And that's the death knell of a creative place, arrogance.
And I ask this in the form of a question. So it is not possible then for us to either create a genius cluster or to predict what the next genius cluster, where that will be?
I would say yes, with the caveat. We can't create one the way you can build a car or build a highway in such a deliberate way. And predicting them is about as tricky as predicting the weather in Boston 2 weeks from today, as an example. It's not that the weather is random and obeys no laws. It does. But it's a complex system, and it's very difficult to figure out how one variable affects another. So, difficult to predict, probably impossible to manufacture, but you can lay the groundwork. You can do certain things, such as having an openness to experience, which is extremely important, traveling, having both tolerance and discernment. I mean, there are things you can do in a place that make it more likely. I mean, I think we could pretty much guarantee that the world's next genius cluster is probably not going to be Pyongyang in North Korea. That's safe to predict because it's not an open place and it's not a tolerant place. And so, yeah, difficult to predict, but, you know, we can. It's like growing vegetables. You need to do certain things to make it more likely that your garden will flourish.
The name of the new book is The Geography of Genius, a search for the world's most creative places from ancient Athens to Silicon Valley. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Eric Weiner, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, too. I enjoyed this.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, The Geography of Genius, by Eric Weiner, published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.